With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom. Simply visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference today.
Monday morning, health hacks here at RCR, Reality Check Radio. Dr. Glenn Davies, reversalnz.co.nz, joins us again to, well, talk about, this is a big picture, the future of medicine. Hi, Glenn. How you doing?
Hey, Paul. I'm fantastic and great to be talking to you this morning.
Yeah, good to have you too. And this is so big that I wonder if we've got the time to get through it all, the future of medicine.
Yeah, we're going to have to go quick. But just to begin with, I think I'm largely talking about primary care, which is general practice, because that's what I do. I would say that secondary and tertiary care, which is hospital medicine, is actually doing a pretty good job. I think they're clear about what they do, and they do it well. So I'm largely limiting my comments to what I know, which is general practice and primary care.
And where do you want to start?
Well, I've got in my mind a picture of a field full of cars. So I was thinking, if I was a mechanic and I owned a workshop and every morning 8 cars came in, I need 8 cars to leave at the end of the day.
Yep.
So what happens if 8 cars come in the morning and only 7 cars leave? After a year, 365 cars are going to be in my workshop. And I say to my apprentice, please go and get that Peugeot that came in a year ago. It's just not going to work, is it? It's going to be buried in the middle of 365 cars. And I really like that analogy. I think that's what's happening to primary care. I think it's an overwhelmed system. It's no longer functioning effectively. The doctors are overwhelmed. The patients aren't getting the care that they need. And what we're going to explore is my thoughts on why it's overwhelmed.
Okay, well, let's start right there. Why? Why?
Well, I reckon we have to go back 200 years. So we're back in France, and I won't do a French accent. I was trying that before I came on.
Well, you said Peugeot, so that probably qualifies.
So no French accent. But 200 years ago, Louis Pasteur and Antoine Beauchamp, they were two French physicians. And Pasteur said he was sort of the father of pasteurization. So the idea of heating a liquid to a reasonable temperature to kill the bacteria. I think he did that in wine, and it led to pasteurization of milk. But he said it's all about the germs. It's all about the bacteria. The idea is that we're just these vulnerable hosts. A germ floats past. We unfortunately breathe it in. It makes us horrendously sick, and sometimes we die.
Yeah.
And Beauchamp said, well, that's ridiculous, you silly man. He said, no, it's all to do with the health of the terrain. He called it the terrain model. It's all to do with the health of the host. And if your immune system is strong, you'll resist that bacteria or virus or bug, and you won't get sick. Now, probably there's truth on both sides, but I would say that Beauchamp was more correct than Pasteur. But yeah, unfortunately, Pasteur won the academic battle. He won the argument, and that germ theory has become the predominant concept in medicine for the last 200 years until this radio show today, where we're going to suggest that there's a better way of doing it.
Yeah, winning the argument, that's an interesting one. I wonder why that was, because it makes common sense. The health of the host would be significant. Was it because that there was such an enthusiasm for new discoveries that you think that there was a preferred kind of, we'll go with Pasteur?
Yeah, well, interesting. I actually think it was due to the personality of the person who proposed it. The people that win these battles seem to be well-connected. They seem to be very good orators. They seem to be persuasive. They make connections with the people that fund. And it happens. We've spoken before Oh, name's escaping me. I'm sorry, but that tends to be what happens. You know, they're strong personalities, whereas the others are often laboratory scientists who go, "Well, my results will be the proof of the pudding."
Yeah, it's not as sexy. Sorry to use that word, but
no, it's not.
It's not. Yeah. Hmm.
So we've actually seen this play out since 2020. With the COVID-19 response, haven't we? And, you know, if you think about that, the idea has been if we protect ourselves from the germs by isolation and we take a vaccine that increases our immunity, we're not going to get sick from COVID. That's germ theory 101 played out greatly. And it was a very, very small voice for the terrain theory that said, well, how about let's getting out and getting some sunshine? How about eating well? How about making social connection? How about protecting the terrain or the host? And then we're less likely to get sick. So we've definitely seen this play out in the last 4 years.
Okay. Sorry, I've just had a cop car go by, which just... made me forget what I was just about to ask you. So just obviously time out here. Just let me think of where I was going to go on that. Damn, I hate it when that happens.
And Ansel Keys was who I was going to talk about. So is it all right if we went back to
sure.
where I lost my train of thought?
Pick it up from there and I might regain mine. So go for it.
So Paul, it seems to be the person with the strongest voice, and we saw that play out with Ansel Keys, who sort of promoted the cholesterol saturated fat argument. Some people described him as a narcissist, but he was certainly a bully. I'm not sure about Pasteur's personality, but I think we've seen this play out throughout history.
Yeah, and recently, let's say.
Recently. So, you know, since 2020, we've seen the germ theory, you know, play out very, very strongly with the response to COVID-19. The idea that if you isolate and you protect yourself from being exposed to the germ, and then you have a vaccine to create immunity so that if you do meet the virus, you're not going to get sick. That is germ theory 101. And the voice for the terrain theory was very, very quiet. You know, we didn't hear a lot of talk about getting sunlight, eating well, vitamin D, getting enough sleep. In fact, that argument was pretty well crushed because this was germ theory and we didn't want to hear from the terrain theorists.
You've just triggered me to remember I watched an interview, one of John Campbell's interviews recently, talking with a woman who had a lot of knowledge when it comes to, which she claimed to, but she seemed legit, the spread of pathogens, germs and pathogens. And I think would it be fair to say that no one really knows how it actually spreads? Because I think in some sort of analysis that was done, it showed that, and UK has a lot of villages, right? And they're spaced at particular spacing. One village would come down with COVID infections, and then in a very regularly repeated sort of time stamp, it would appear at the next villages and then the next village, suggesting that it actually wasn't transmitted person to person through direct contact, that it was on the wind. And then talked about the scale of these particles, that they're incredibly small and essentially weightless. So I'm just wondering what you think about that.
Well, it's interesting. There's another theory I've heard people talk about. When you look at influenza starting, it will pop up on the same day, almost the same hour, at multiple different places along a latitude. You know, so it's almost like it's tulips popping out of the ground. And that's more of an argument for host theory. Is there something environmental or something within the humans' response that allows a latent virus to resurface, which is very, very different from this idea of the bugs floating around on the wind. I'm not sure that we have this answered completely yet.
Okay, so anything more to say specifically about germ versus host theory?
Yeah, so I just I want to go back to talking about this in relation to primary care in New Zealand. And primary care in New Zealand or general practice is basically using the pharmaceutical model. So I wanted to compare the pharmaceutical model with lifestyle medicine. So first of all, the pharmaceutical medicine largely treats the symptoms. It's not treating the cause of the problem. That's not 100% true, but I think in a majority of cases, we just treat the symptoms. If you think of high blood pressure as an example, we've talked about that before on the show. High blood pressure, the blood pressure is up. We lower the number on the dial and we say that we've treated the high blood pressure, but we don't ask what caused the high blood pressure. Now, as the listeners here know, it's probably insulin resistance from eating too much carbohydrate.
Yeah.
If you use lifestyle medicine, you'll deal with the cause of the problem, which is eating ultra-processed food, and you don't need the pharmaceutical agent for the high blood pressure. You know, so treat the cause and not the symptoms. I think in pharmaceutical medicine, we have dependent patients. The word patient comes from the Latin word party. It means to be subservient, to do what you're told. In lifestyle medicine, we have the exact opposite. We have empowered clients that use the internet. They do their research and they use the doctor or the clinician more as a resource. They're not going, I'm sick, fix me. They're going, I have this problem, I've investigated it, and I need your help with this aspect. It's a very, very different way of interacting with clients or patients. Germ theory, what's kind of appealing about it is it's quick and efficient. You know, you go to your doctor and you say, I've got the symptom. He does this algorithm in his head and he goes, for that symptom, we use this recipe. We're going to give you this medicine. You know, you go, I've got indigestion. Doctor goes, omeprazole or Losec, which is low as acid, and you get a prescription. And, you know, quite literally, you can be out of there in 5 minutes. Now, that doesn't happen with the more holistic medical approach, where we're trying to work out what's the cause. You know, so if you said, I've got indigestion, we might go, how are you sleeping? What are you eating? What are your stress levels? What makes it worse? What makes it better? What have you tried in the past? You know, that's not a 5 minute consultation. So that's a dramatic difference. In germ theory, you're on the doctor's agenda. You know, the doctor is running the consultation. Whereas with host theory, we're more using the coach approach and the client drives the agenda or drives the consultation. Germ theory is cheap to the patient. You know, we are so lucky that, you know, because I'm not bagging medicines, you know, there's a place for medicines. I just think they're used too often, but we're so lucky that the government will fund these very, very expensive medicines, and it will only cost us, I think at the moment it's zero and soon it'll be $5. But, you know, we're so lucky that each item is available to us at that cheap. You know, whereas with lifestyle medicine, it's privately funded. Yeah. And then I don't think that this pharmaceutical model is sustainable because we have to actually cure some people. We have to make them better and we have to stop them coming back into our clinics. And that's not happening if we just treat the symptoms. And medical students and nursing students are only taught pharmaceutical medicine. They're not taught lifestyle medicine. So I think it's something like 6 hours of nutrition training in a full 6-year degree. Whereas I would argue that nutrition is the most important aspect of medicine. Why does it just get 6 hours? And probably of those 6 hours, most of it's wrong. We've talked about the food pyramid before. And I think what's resulting is we've got frustrated patients because they're not getting better, and we've got frustrated clinicians because all of us as clinicians, we want to be healers, we want to see results, and we want our clients to feel energetic and vibrant and alive and well. We want to be healers, and at the moment, we're just being pushers for the pharmaceutical industry. We're drug dealers, basically.
Okay. A couple of things. I suppose the more you do lifestyle medicine and the client becomes empowered in the way that you described, those patterns and those algorithms that you talked about will start to form up around that form of consultation, won't they? So the more you go into it, the greater the sort of understanding becomes. Am I right?
Yeah, definitely right. One of the big differences is if you're on the client's agenda, you're just listening. You're listening to what you're being told. You haven't quickly formed an idea and going, how am I going to prescribe this medicine and get this person out of my room so I can see my busy waiting room? So it does require more time, and it's a different way of thinking. But you know what? Doctors are highly trained in diagnosis. You know, we are really, really skilled, but it takes time. If you don't give a doctor enough time, you can't make the diagnosis of the cause of the problem.
Just quickly, I have an experience of high blood pressure and blood pressure medication. And since talking with you and others, Glenn, I've sort of rejigged what I eat. I do my 30 Ks a week if I can, out running. It's not as fast as it used to be, but I'm not so young anymore. And I've found that the results from that were far better than being on the medication. I felt sort of like sometimes in a different dimension on that stuff, and my thinking and the fuzziness and the, you know, lightheadedness and stuff like that. And it's just such a difference. And I've kind of achieved the same result. So just saying.
Yeah. And I'm just, as you talk, Paul, I'm thinking of a woman who was telling me about a husband who went on a pie and whiskey diet for 3 weeks while he was on a motorcycle tour in the South Island with his friends. Blood pressure went up to 210 systolic. She came back, gave him a bit of a telling off, put him back on his low-carb diet, and it's now back down to 130. You know, so no medications. That's just a dramatic example that a whiskey and pie diet is probably not good for your blood pressure.
Okay, I won't be having that tonight. All right, so where are we at on the chat? I think you've kind of defined lifestyle medicine. What are the key elements of it, though?
Okay. So we talk about the six pillars of lifestyle medicine. So number one, healthy eating. And I'll talk a little bit more in detail about that. Movement or exercise. Restorative sleep. Social connection. And that really references the fact that loneliness is one of the most damaging things to our health. Avoiding risky substances and behaviors. So that's talking about addiction. And stress management. And we've talked about this before, how we want our parasympathetic nervous system, the chill side of the nervous system, to be dominating and not the fight or flight sympathetic stress response to be dominating. Those are the six fundamentals of lifestyle medicine.
Mitochondria, we've chatted about that before as well. This is a really base level now, right?
Yeah, I'm just mentioning it. Probably in the end, everything that we are doing to be healthy requires us to look after our mitochondria, the little batteries within every cell that produce energy. So everything that our body does requires energy. And if we're not looking after the batteries, we're not going to have good health.
Yeah, the batteries. Okay, so we've talked a lot about nutrition, eat food, whole food. Recently growing, walking, swimming, or flying, we know that. Less than five ingredients, you say here. No numbers on ingredients you can't pronounce. Okay. Are you talking about like those massive, long sort of chemical names?
Yeah. You know, why would you put that in your body? Even worse, why would you put it on your skin? You know, look at some skincare products and they're just numbers. You know, you absorb stuff through your skin. So don't eat it. Don't put it on your skin. Just try and have whole food, simple whole food. Those rules that you just read out, they're you know, that's basically it. Eat whole food.
Can I ask you a question about, because I'm thinking about vitamin D and the sun, what about the slip, slop, slap? We've probably touched on that before, but most people are kind of afraid of the sun. And by the idea that we should always sort of cover our skin with the stuff. And I know the skin's very absorbent, isn't it? And it's a big surface area, potentially. What do you think about that?
There was a fascinating article I read through Epoch Times talking about that very issue. And some of the skin cancers are caused by the sun, but they tend to be the less aggressive ones. When you look at melanoma, which is the most dangerous of the skin cancers, it may not be. So if you look at skin cancer as a total subject, you would strongly argue that it's caused by the sun. But if you looked at deaths from skin cancers, they would largely fall into the melanoma group, which may not be caused by the sun. You know, my conclusion I'm coming to is that cancer is the result of injury, and it probably takes a series of injuries to cause it. So, you know, if you've got radiation, then you've got an injury, and then perhaps you've got a challenge to your immune system. You add those three things together, you might get cancer, particularly if you've got a genetic predisposition. You know, I think for the majority of people, sunlight alone is probably not going to be enough. So, you know, I think there's perhaps as much risk from the sunscreen as there is from the sun itself, but it's all about balance. You know, you've got to get the balance right with all of these things. Lying in the midday sun for 3 hours naked is not going to be good for you. You know, you don't want to get sunburnt because that's an injury. But if it's short of an injury, it's probably beneficial, particularly around that vitamin D issue.
Well, I won't do that then. Thank you for that advice. Dr. Glenn told me not to do that.
Yes, you're not in the middle of winter.
No one would want to see that, I'm telling you. I'm thinking of a Benny Hill joke, but I'm not going to repeat it. Okay, so moving through to the end of the chat, I'm looking at your page now. Results are in, results pending, large ongoing cohort studies. Should we start with the results are in?
Yeah. Well, like I think there's two massive ongoing studies going at the moment. One started 70 years ago, and that was the introduction of the food pyramid, where we were told to eat 6 to 11 servings of carbohydrate per day. And I think the results are in. It's been an appalling and dismal failure. We have the highest levels of every chronic disease you can think of as a direct consequence of the food pyramid. So that has been a dismal failure. Turn it upside down. And stop eating all these carbs. But the second one only started arguably in 2020, and that's the COVID-19 vaccination program. We have 5.5 billion in the study group and 2.5 billion in the control group. And we're just now looking at the results. And the results are fascinating, but one thing that's perplexing me is that science and medicine seem to be reluctant to look at the consequences of this massive, exciting experiment. And what I'd be encouraging is that we actually start looking at these results and we look at them, you know, in an open way. And we are, my inbox gets flooded every day now by science and by studies that are coming out looking at COVID-19. So we are starting to see it, but I don't think we're being aggressive enough at investigating the results of this big ongoing cohort study.
I can hear a whole lot of people saying, yeah, I agree with that right now. All right. So the elephant in the room.
Yeah. So, you know, I just mentioned that briefly. It's the food pyramid has caused all of these problems, and we really need to change the way that we're eating. And the key to eating well so that we have a healthy terrain, a healthy host, so that we can resist these bugs when they come along. The number one thing, I think this is probably 90% of it, is to eat better. And that basically means avoiding these ultra-processed foods, avoiding sugars, and avoiding these polyunsaturated vegetable oils like canola oil and sunflower oil. If we just did those things, I think our immune system would be so much stronger. So reduce the carbs. You know, don't choose the hamburger and chips. Choose the steak and salad. And then the next thing is, if we're going to fix some of these chronic conditions which are overwhelming the healthcare system, you know, we're basically being overwhelmed by the conditions caused by eating ultra-processed food and sugar. You know, that's obesity, diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, Alzheimer's, cancer. They are all completely or partially the result of eating too much carbohydrate. If we turned that around, we would save general practice because we would no longer be overwhelmed with all of these sick people, because people would get better, because we've dealt with the cause of the problem, created a healthy terrain. And that can be as simple as cutting out sugar, or as simple as cutting out the white carbs. But for some people, it might involve some intermittent fasting, Some people might need to do keto. Some might even do carnivore. You know, it might require a more dramatic intervention for some people.
It feels to me like there's not much time to get this right, actually.
No, well, I think general practice is really struggling. We've got waiting times blown out in some places to 6 weeks. We've got a burnt out resource, doctors and nurses. We've got 50% of our doctors and nurses are due to retire within the next 10 years, and we don't have enough to replace them. You know, people's are getting sicker, but they're demanding more in terms of their healthcare. You know, so I just can't see this continuing unless we change something dramatically. And what I'd argue we have to change is we actually have to turn that food pyramid upside down. People have to start eating well, and they actually have to start getting better. And that will decompress general practice, and it will survive and continue to be a wonderful resource for people when they need it.
Clean out the mechanic's yard.
Yeah, 8 cars come in the morning, 9 leave in the afternoon.
That's what I
really envisage happening. And then when you really need your GP, you can book a 30-minute appointment the next day. Your GP's got time to listen. They've got time to make the diagnosis. They will deal with the cause of the problem. At the moment, there's just no time. And the quickest thing is to prescribe a medicine which only treats the symptoms.
Great information, Glenn. Good to have you back again this week on Health Hacks. And we'll do it all again in another week. Thanks for coming back on.
Hey, thank you, Paul. And what I'd like to talk about next week is I'd like to sort of review the social cost of COVID-19 response. And I know it's a difficult topic to talk about, but I really think it's time that we start talking openly about, you know, this big 5.5 billion people in the study group with a very significant control group. I think it's time we just start looking at it more openly, discussing it. I think enough time has passed where we can start having open conversations about the response. What did we do well? What did we do badly? I think it's time.
I'm looking forward to that already. So that's next Monday at around this time here at RCR. Thank you, Dr. Glenn Davies, reversalnz.co.nz. This week's Health Hacks. See you in a week, Glenn.
See you, Paul.
With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.